Hey, folks, thanks for listening to the podcast. I want to let you know that the show is sponsored by Hulu Plus. Hulu Plus is amazing. It's like having a TV and a movie theater in your pocket. It lets you binge on thousands of hit shows anytime, anywhere, on your TV, PC, smartphone, tablet, doesn't matter. And I want you guys to really experience it the way I am. So through this podcast, we're able to offer you a two-week free trial offer to check it out. Real simple. Go to HuluPlus.com/Paul or go to SideshowNetwork.tv and click on the Hulu Plus banner. You get 2 free weeks, and when you do that, sign up. It also helps support this podcast. We get credit for it, and we'd really appreciate that. So please check it out. I think you're going to fall in love with it. It's SideshowNetwork.tv and click on the Hulu Plus banner or HuluPlus.com/Paul.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One gang could run this city. One gang. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey, thanks for checking out the podcast. This week, very excited to have on 3-time Super Bowl champ, Pro Bowler, and ESPN's NFL analyst, Mark Schlereth. Mark's a great guy. He and I did something together at ESPN, and we have a really cool conversation about playing in the NFL, what's it like to play the offensive line, the strategies and the battles that go on during a game, policing the NFL locker room, and a pretty eye-opening story about something that happens on the field that I think you'd be surprised to hear. And if you want to check me out doing stand-up, I'm in New York City this week. And follow me on Twitter, at Paul Mercurio. I want you guys to all follow me on Twitter. Tell your friends to follow me, too, at Paul Mercurio. Thanks for checking out the podcast.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
Very excited to welcome this week to the podcast, Mark Schlereth, the great 3-time Super Bowl champ, a former Redskins and Denver Bronco, analyst for ESPN and host of his own radio show on ESPN. Also, entrepreneur, his line of green chili, stinking good green chili. Welcome to the show, Mark. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
You got it, Paul. It's my pleasure, man.
Yeah, I got to kind of work with you a little bit at ESPN on something, and we had a great time, and we connected. And by the way, how did Stinkin' Good came up? It came up off your nickname, Stink, right? For people who may not know how that nickname came about, tell them how you got that nickname.
Yeah, actually, you know, the whole nickname, now, there is the urban legend. There's two versions. There's the urban legend and there's the truth. I'll give you both of them.
All right.
Do you want the truth first? Or do you want the urban legend
okay,
first?
Okay, here's the one I got. You grew up in Alaska, and it was you would cut fish and eat fish.
Okay, that's not the urban legend. That's the truth. That's the actual truth. And what ended up happening in 1989, I was a rookie with the Washington Redskins, and my sister was teaching at an Eskimo village called Akiachuk, Alaska, on the Kuskokwim River. Mm-hmm. And the village doesn't even exist anymore, but that's where she was teaching school. And it was kind of a ritual. The first run of salmon during the season, then the villagers would dip net the salmon out of the Kuskokwim. So they just throw their nets in there and they pull a slew of salmon out. And they would take those fish and they'd cut off the heads, and they would bury the heads in the ground, and they would let them rot in the ground, and then they would dig them up weeks later and create a dish out of this rotten fish head. Ugh. And they called those fish heads, they call them stink heads. And so, you know, it's interesting because I'm telling the story as a rookie, and all the veteran players are there like, oh, my God, that's awful. And the fact that I was from Alaska, that's the next thing you know, you become Stinkhead. And that was how the original nickname was Stinkhead, and then it gets shortened to Stink over time. Stinkhead was apparently too long, so it just became Stink. And from that point forward, you know, I know if you know me, when you call, if you call and I answer my phone, and you call me Mark, then we're acquaintances. If you call me Stink, we're friends.
Ah, okay, all right. Well, I hope someday I can call you Stink. I know you're.
Well, that's how that whole thing goes, Paul. But the interesting thing, the urban legend is, and it's true, but it's not how I got the nickname. The urban legend is, I used to urinate in my pants every game.
Wait, are you serious? Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was miserable anyhow. You know, I had 29 surgeries while I was playing. I had 20 knee surgeries, back surgeries, elbow surgeries, kidney surgery. So I had all kinds of issues. And I just was like, I'm not going to sit here and be miserable in the huddle if I have to pee. So I would just, sometimes I'd just stand there and TV timeout or whatever, and I'd be just going to the bathroom. As a matter of fact, I'm playing in a game in Washington, probably my second year in the league, my third year in the league. Now, I was a starting right guard in Washington. I started left guard in Denver, but I was starting right guard, and I had played. It was a sultry summer night in the nation's capital, and just steamy and hot, and had just played, two and a half, three quarters of football, right? And so you're sweating on the sideline, and I'm out of the game. Now, I was the starting guard, but I was a young player still, and we had a bunch of older, the Hogs. We had a bunch of older veteran offensive linemen.
Yeah, I lived in D.C., and I followed you guys, Joe Jacoby and Grimm.
It was me and Grimmie and Joe Jacoby and Raleigh McKenzie and Jeff Bostic. And so we had all, I was one of the starters, and Jimmy Lachey, and our starting offensive line was Jimmy Lachey, Russ Grimm, Jeff Bostic, myself, and Joe Jacoby. Mm-hmm. And then, later on, Ed Simmons was in there, and Raleigh McKenzie was in there in the mix. But, we had a kind of veteran group. So we were all done for the night. And it's, like I said, it's a hot, just steamy, sultry night. And I'm sitting on the bench, and I'm sitting next to Raleigh McKenzie. Now, as a young player, I'm first guy up in case somebody gets hurt, right? And I also came in as a center. So I could play center, I could play guard, I could play right, left, or guard, right or left guard or center. So I'm sitting on the bench, and I'm, looking at Raleigh, and, there's 70, or back, it was old RFK, so it was 56,000 was packed, right? Mm-hmm. And the crowd's crazy, and I'm sitting on the bench with Raleigh, and I go, man, I gotta take a leak. I was like, oh. So I was just like, well, what the heck, I'm all sweaty anyhow. So I completely empty my bladder, I'm sitting there, and Raleigh's like, dude, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, look at all these people. And I turn around, I start waving to the fans, and I go, all these people have no idea that I'm peeing right now. I'm like, hey, how you doing? How's it going? So anyhow, I literally get done kind of shaking it off, on the bench. You got to finish, right? So you got to shake a little bit. And as soon as I get done, there's no lie, somebody gets hurt. And they're like, Jesus. So they're like, stink, 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 we need you. So-and-so got hurt. So I jump up and I run over there, and it's the backup center, and I have to go in. So Stan Humphries is our backup quarterback. He goes, let me get a couple practice snaps, and we're on the sideline. It's it's an injury timeout. Right. And I just emptied my bladder. And so he gets in there, and he goes, I get over the ball, he goes, blue lady, and I snap it up there, and just splash, just total splash down. He's all wet, and he's like, oh, my God, he's sopping wet with sweat. He goes, somebody get him a towel. And so they got to dry off my undercarriage with a towel. And I'm like, that's not sweat, man. That's urine. But, little did he know. So, that's the urban legend aspect of it. That's not how I got the nickname, but it is true that I used to piss my pants all the time.
I look at you in a whole other light now. I mean, because, listen, I do stand-up, and there have been times when I go on stage, and you always, I'm sure you like any performer or whatever, you're performing to 60,000 people, me in front of people, you get a little nervous, you go on stage, you had some beverages before. I've had to piss my pants on stage. I never thought, I'll just do it right here. I guess people would notice it a little bit more if I did it, but Jesus, I love
it. That's what they make the Penn's undergarments for. That's, you just slap one of those bad boys on, you're good to go.
You need to come up with a stink line of undergarments, man. You have the reason for it. You could do a little infomercial, and then you're like, this is me. See that picture right there? I just peed my pants. I didn't have undergarments, but now I just...
Exactly. I'm with you 100%. Hey, hook that up, and we'll both make some money on it.
That's it, right? And then and I could stand next to you, and it's my buddy Stink here. I hang out with him all the time, even though he's sopping wet like a baby.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
I knew you from being a player and an analyst, and then I got to work with you on this project at ESPN, and I was honestly a little intimidated and excited because I looked up to you because I was a huge Redskins fan. I lived in Washington, D.C. for the few years that you were playing, and because of the Hogs, if people don't know who are listening, the Hogs was the offensive line in the NFL, and literally on Sundays, you would get on the Metro. They call it the Metro. They call it the subway in New York. You get on the Metro in D.C., and there are adult men and women with pig noses and, you know, all sorts of pig paraphernalia going to see the Redskins. And my favorite teams are all Boston teams because I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. So the Patriots, my first team. But the Redskins became my adopted, like, second team because of you guys. And I thank you for that because it was amazing to watch, to be in that city at that time. Talk about that and what it was like to be like, have the elder statesmen like the Joe Jacobys and the Grimms like above you. I would imagine you learned from them, and what, if anything, did you learn from them other than to piss your pants in front of 60,000 people and get away with it?
they didn't give me that. That was, I was all on my own.
It was your own invention.
Yeah, that was my own deal. But yeah, those guys were awesome from day one, and to get drafted to the Washington Redskins that had such a tradition,
yeah,
you know, winning tradition, and just a wonderful head coach in Joe Gibbs, and then, you know, to be a part of an offensive line that was just legendary, and to come into there and to get to be a part of that and to get to start as a rookie with those guys mentoring you was tremendous. And to watch, you know, to watch their preparation and watch the way they got themselves ready to play and to learn football from those guys, it was an honor. It was a pleasure. Those guys were wonderful mentors, and they were great football players, some of the greatest football players ever. And they were so tight knit. You know, there was such a unity there. And you know, you really believe that. You know, it's the offensive line is like this living, breathing organism, that it's five people from different backgrounds. You know, they come from different parts of the country and different kind of economic backgrounds and different, just you name it, it's completely different. And all five guys have to become one guy and have one mind and see the same things and be able to communicate those things, even if it's just kind of visceral with a grunt or whatever. And that to me is the beauty of playing that position. And those guys were so in tune with each other and welcomed me. And, you know, it's always one of those things, the rookie hazing stuff, Paul. We always hear about the rookie hazing stuff.
Yeah.
But for me, it was a really interesting time because, you know, the respect, this just shows you the respect that the team had for the offensive line, because the offensive line ran the show. It wasn't the quarterback. You know, it wasn't the deal. It was the offensive line,
yeah,
the Washington Redskins. It was the Hogs that ran everything. I mean, they,
yeah,
were large and in charge.
Yeah.
And Grimmie comes up to me, Russ Grimm, as I'm a rookie, goes, hey, by the way, he goes, when all this stuff starts, you know, all the singing, you know, they cling the glasses. They take their forks or their knives and they hit the glasses, and then they make people get up and sing at the cafeteria during lunch or during dinner, right?
Right.
And Grimmie goes, listen, you don't sing for anybody but me. Nobody but me. And he goes, and because I never go to lunch and at dinner I'm always drinking, I never come to dinner. He goes, you're not going to have to probably sing. But unless I tell you to sing, you don't sing. And I was like, all right, sounds good to me. So, you know, this whole slew of rookies is singing, you know, and everybody gets up. And Monty Coleman was one of the elder statesmen on the football team. He played 17 years. You remember Monty. Played 17 years at linebacker. Built like a Greek god, just chiseled from a piece of granite. One of the most wonderful men you will ever meet. And just noble and, I mean, big and strong. And I mean, this guy was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ding, 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 he hits the glass and he says, hey, you know, Rook, you get up and sing. So I stood up and I said, well, I'm sorry. Russ told me I couldn't sing unless he was here. And he's not here right now. And Monty, like, looked around the cafeteria and goes, all right, sit down. And that was, you know, nobody else in the world could have gotten away with that, right?
Wow.
But they were like, oh, yeah, Russ isn't, yeah, you're right, Russ isn't here, and we're not going to cross Russ because Russ is in charge of the team.
Yeah.
So, okay, sit back down. I never ended up having to sing. I never ended up having to do any of the rookie stuff because Russ wasn't around. And they didn't have the approval of Russ to make me do it. So,
oh, that's amazing.
I mean, that's kind of how the Hogs worked that team with Washington.
Hey folks, thanks for checking out the podcast. Paul here. I want to talk to you about Hulu Plus. I really want you guys to check this out. I signed up for it and absolutely love it, and it's changed the way I watch TV and movies and probably saved my life. Last week, I'm stuck on a plane The TV screen in the seat in front of me is not working. I got nothing to do in a 3.5 hour flight, and an insurance salesman sitting next to me who's trying to sell me life insurance like you wouldn't believe, to the point where I'm thinking the only way I'm going to get away from this guy is if I buy life insurance and then jump out of the plane. Instead, I put on Hulu Plus, and everything was right with the world. I watched 5 episodes back to back of The Twilight Zone. How great is that series? Rod Serling, old school. That's the great thing about Hulu Plus. You can watch current TV shows, old TV shows, Friday Night SmackDown, Community. You want it, it's got it. It's a TV in your pocket. Really fast downloads. I want you guys to check it out. We're going to offer you a 2-week free trial period because you're listeners to this podcast. It's really simple. Go to HuluPlus.com/Paul or SideshowNetwork.tv and click on the Hulu Plus banner. You get 2 free weeks, and when you sign up, we get credit for it, and it helps support this podcast, which we really appreciate. You're going to love it. You're going to enjoy it. You're going to tell your friends about it. Go check it out. It's HuluPlus.com/Paul or SideshowNetwork.tv and click on the Hulu Plus banner. If you like it after 2 weeks, it's only $7.99 a month. $8 a month. I spend $8 a month on penicillin shots.
You know, the thing that strikes me, you know, a couple of things, and what I really wanted to get into with you is, I feel like offensive lineman and the offensive line is the sort of the least glamorous sort of position, if you will, and it should be the most glamorous in some ways, because I think you're right. Without a good offensive line, you can make a great quarterback look unbelievable. You can make an average quarterback look great if you get him enough time. And talk about two things for me. One is I want to follow up on what you just said about you play as a unit. You play as 5 separate organisms that play at one. Do you think that that's only true of the offensive line versus, say, the defensive line or the cornerbacks, and why is that more so important for the offensive line than maybe other positions on the field?
Yeah, well, I think the thing you have to understand is most of the other guys are in these individual battles most of the time, and you know, it's about their own individual sacks. I mean, think about a defensive lineman. It's all about how many sacks they got, right? So there's a different mentality that goes into playing that position. Yeah, I have never met an offensive lineman that's not completely neurotic, that's not completely motivated out of fear and paranoia, that we are all the same. We're completely
the same. What is that fear and paranoia that you're going to miss it? You're going to miss a block, and you're going to miss a block.
Well, think about it. You know, most guys that play love playing on Monday nights. You ask, you know, Monday night is just the only stage, right? You're the guy. You're the team. So you talk to the quarterbacks, the receivers, the DB, or whoever. It's their chance to become a star. Mm-hmm. As an offensive lineman, the only thing that can happen is bad stuff. Right? You give up, it's 3rd-and-12 at the end of the game, you give up a sack, and you're the schlub who plays left guard that gave up a sack and cost your team.
Right. Meanwhile, if you're buying your quarterback a lot of time, well, he's just doing what he's supposed to do, and it's none of the accolade,
right.
All of the grief.
All right, your running back goes for 220 yards, and he's a superstar, and you become a throwaway line. Like, hey, the big guys up front, they really did their job. You know, nobody gets you by name. You just become the big guy up front.
Right.
And so, as a defensive lineman, the same guy that I'm playing against, the same guy that I'm a 65 plays, 70 plays, I whip his ass 64 plays in a row. He's the guy that gets the sack at the end of the game that ends the game, and we don't end up kicking the game-tying field goal or the game-winning field goal. He goes to the Pro Bowl. And I'm looking for work. That's the nature of that position. And so you have to be tied together. You have to rely on one another. You have to, you know, you have to be willing to kind of jump on the hand grenade for one another because you're really that tied together. And it's unique in football. Probably unique in any team sport. It's a game and a team within the team. The offensive line is its own separate kind of entity, and its own separate team.
I want you to expand on that a little bit, because that's exactly kind of the impression that I've gotten, you know, just as a viewer. But, you know, you've played against the likes of Dana Stubblefield, Warren Sapp, Cortez Kennedy. How much is improvisation play a part of what you're doing out there on a play-to-play basis? I know you're within a set play and you got to pick up your assignment, but then I would think as the game's going on and you're playing against Sapp or whatever, and you're starting to figure out, okay, he's doing a lot of this tonight. He's moving a lot to his right, or he's got a hitch here or something. Are you adjusting as you're going through the game? Is there this sort of dance that's happening between you and your individual opponent that things are changing during the course of the game? And are you improvising, staying within the set play, are you improvising to kind of accommodate for that?
Yeah, there's a lot of feel that goes into it, but really, for the most part, most of the things you do during the game are predetermined based on your film study and how you've gotten yourself prepared to play. And I'll give you a Warren Sapp story. I played Warren Sapp. I played him a bunch, but I played him probably, I think it was 1999. And sometimes you get the year screwed up. I took a lot of shots to the head, so forgive me if I do, but I think it was 1999. Now, I'm coming off of a knee that needs an operation, a back that I just had an epidural, and I had a lot of injury issues. And the kid they kept to back me up wasn't ready to play. I mean, if we'd have put him in the game, he would have got a quarterback killed. He could never have played against Warren Sapp. So I'm like, I don't practice all week. I'm beat, but I studied a ton of film. And going into the game, Warren Sapp had like 7.5 sacks in the first 2 weeks of the season. I mean, it was crazy how good he was. And essentially, he had developed this outside pass rush move and everybody was getting just slaughtered by this move. And so I went in with this plan to go against him. I'm like, I'm not going to let him, as a left guard, I'm never going to let him touch my left hand. So essentially, I'm not even going to punch him. I'm not going to stick my left hand out there, because that's the way everybody gets in trouble. I'm going to set him completely one-handed. And it was phenomenal, because I played him essentially one-handed in that game and just stonewalled him. I mean, just shut him down in that game. And that was one of those things where, you know, you have a plan going in, and that plan completely works. Now, there are times where you go in with this great plan, and maybe that defense is doing something different. Like, we played the New England Patriots when I was with the Denver Broncos, probably, I don't know, late in my career, and they came out. We prepped all week for watching them, and you usually break down the NFL the last 4 weeks. So that's kind of where you get your tendencies and really kind of a lot of the stuff that you watch. But you went through this whole game plan and all this preparation work that you did to get yourself ready to play, and they come out an entirely different defense, something that we had never – so now you're over on the sideline after the first series. Like, what are they doing? Well, they were in this. They're in this. They're doing this. And so it becomes sandlot. I mean, you're just scribbling plays on a grease board going, okay, well, we're going to try to run this if they get in this. And if they – I mean, it was a phenomenal job of coaching by Bill Belichick and his staff. And it was one of those things. And we lost that game. It threw us for a loop because we just didn't adjust very well. So there is that give and take, and there is that preparation, and there is some of that stuff during the course of a game where you're like, they're not giving us what we thought they were going to give us. Change up the game plan.
Now, I would think in the case of Warren Sapp, if you've got his number and he, after, say, a quarter of this, he's like, damn, Mark's got my number, Stink's got my number, what's going on? Why isn't he making an adjustment and then you're making an adjustment on his adjustment? You know what I mean? Why is he sticking to his routine and not changing up a bit?
Well, you will obviously change up, but the thing you have to understand, again, it goes back to being a good offensive line, is that your number, your opportunities to rush me one-on-one are going to be very – when you're a Warren Sapp, they're going to be very limited. I mean, they're not going to leave me one-on-one with Warren Sapp the whole game, because I'll get killed, right?
Yeah.
So essentially what we ended up doing is you turn protect, you send a fullback through the B gap, and you just do different things. And the other thing about Warren Sapp was, unlike Cortez Kennedy, who you mentioned, Cortez and I played, we played against each other all the time because we were in the same division at the time, the Seahawks and the Broncos, my last 6 years in the National Football League, we were in the same division. So
right.
I played left guard, so we lined up against each other every play. So he had a lot, we had a lot more one-on-one opportunities. But Warren Sapp was a flip-flop guy. So he was a guy that would line up, you know, half the game, depending on your formation. He'd either be over the left guard or he'd flop over to the right guard, depending on how much you were in strong right or strong left. So he'd flip-flop. So, you know, you're normally, you're turning protections to him a lot. You're finding a way to double-team him almost every play. And his opportunity to rush me one-on-one is going to be very limited in any game because, you know, you'd be foolish. I mean, we're old. We're, you know, for offensive linemen, I mean, I was old. I was broken. I was fat. I can't move. The only advantage I have is snap count. I mean, that's, you know, that's so you have to understand what you're dealing with, too. And the great coaches really is an offensive line, a guy that really consumes that and really understands it and really loves that position. Mm-hmm. The great coaches really find a way to eliminate as many one-on-ones as possible on any given play because, yeah, let's face it, those guys on the other side of the ball are much, they're just going to be much better athletes. I mean, there's, you remember the movie Officer and a Gentleman?
Yep.
Mayonnaise. Mm-hmm. You know, I got nowhere else to go, mayonnaise, right? I mean, right. As an offensive lineman, you're one step away from being a fan. I mean, there's no, once you hit that position, there's nowhere else to go, man. You either walk up and sit in the stands or, you know, I mean, it's not like the offensive lineman all of a sudden go, you know what, I'm feeling pretty athletic today. I'm going to play linebacker, you know. Like a safety sometime can go, okay, hey, I've gained a little bit of weight. I'm not quite as fast as I used to be. I'm going to move to linebacker. And that transition happens. Or a linebacker gains a little bit weight, he becomes a little bit bigger and goes, man, I'm going to play rush defensive end or three technique defensive tackle. Or a defensive tackle that maybe lost a little athletic ability moves over to the offensive line. I've seen all those things happen. I've never seen an offensive lineman going, hey, I'm going to slim down a little bit and become a linebacker, right? It just doesn't, that doesn't happen. So you either go, you go from playing offensive line to, like I said, to being a fan. That's it.
Yeah. In the case of like a Cortez Kennedy, and you guys are going up against each other for 5-6 years at a stretch, again, going back to the idea of a game within a game, and I'm fascinated by this, like I would think, you know, he's talking to his coaches going, look, I've been playing stink, you know, he's going to be expecting me to do this. This game I'm going to do some of this. Are there pre-game adjustments that you're making to go up against guys that you have a track record with? You start to know each other's sort of repertoire, and you've got to keep adding some things to what you do to kind of to keep your opponent off balance a little bit.
Yeah, I think and it comes through a game. You know, it comes through what you're trying to do. You know, if you're heavy outside swim guy, maybe you're going to try an inside rip, or you're going to do some other things of that nature as a defensive lineman. As an offensive lineman, really the things I'm going to do is I'm going to change up pass sets. I'm going to consistently change what I do. So if we have, you know, a 7-step drop, I may try to attack you a little bit, get in there a little bit quicker. You know, a 3-step drop, I may come off and just actually run block. And all of a sudden you're defending the run and then we throw it. So there's different depths of set. There's different ways to attack a guy.
Yeah.
And you're just trying to keep guys off balance all the time so that during the course of any given day or any given game, you know, the way you run the ball and the way you attack them in pass pro and things of that nature. And then, you know, from a game plan standpoint, one week we do nothing but zone block stuff. And then, you know, we play them again and we run some trap and we set them up with some things. So now all of a sudden you get them playing on their heels a little bit and them saying, well, wait a minute now. The last time we played, they did a bunch of this, man. I'm expecting that. And we changed things up as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, that gets to another idea. Just the idea that I don't think people realize that you've got to be intelligent to play this game at the level that you guys play it and be able to think on your feet. And I want to talk about, like, sort of in your mind, the percentage of this game, what percentage of this game is physical and mental, and in particular what I call, like, good emotion and bad emotion, because you're in such an emotional play, like you're fighting on the field, you're battling these guys. When is emotion counterproductive? When have you found yourself at times getting too angry on the field and the guys getting the better of you mentally? And where is that line for you on the field, and how important is that playing at that level to know,
yeah,
to be able to keep your emotion, to have good emotion, but keep it in check to the point where you're not out of control and the guy's getting the better of you?
Yeah, it is the part of the game that probably doesn't get talked about enough. And I think, you know, you talk about just pure athleticism and what you're trying to get done as a football player, for instance. And I think one of the big issues, or as any professional athlete, is you've got to be great as an athlete. But I think the thing that really derails most guys from getting to the next level, you know, there's a lot of great college football players, there's a lot of great high school football players, and usually what determines whether you move on or not is can you emotionally keep yourself intact, and can you deal with the ups and the downs, and can you not get busy patting yourself on the back when things are going really great, or get super down when things aren't going as well. And
yeah,
I think the emotional part of that is big, and in the game as well, to have that ability to be aggressive and to be on point and to be, you know, just to go and after people. But at the same time, as you're doing those things, to not get yourself out of control, to draw a 15-yard penalty, and to not be an idiot, you know,
yeah,
to not get...
I don't know how you guys do it. I would get so... I'd start slapping the guy in the helmet and beating him with a pylon. I'd be kind of like, I don't know how you keep that emotion in check, but keep it just on that cutting edge. Have you ever had a game where the guy just got into your head and he was just mentally getting the better of you and you were just getting too amped up? Did you ever have to deal with that?
Most of the time, you know, I was, the emotional part was I was getting my butt whipped. and that's when, you know, you're sitting there going, oh my God, this guy's just totally got my number. And, you know, that's a frustrating thing. But the thing you, and it happens, you know, it happens to the best players in the world. Sometimes somebody just somebody just has the better physically of you. And then, you know, from the mental standpoint, you get frustrated. And the great thing, I think, you can always, you know, when those things happen to you, and they're going to happen to the best players, the great thing about football, which is, this is why I always say I'm a terrible golfer, is because golf is counterintuitive to anything I've ever done, which says if things aren't going well, apply more effort. And, you know, as a football player, when things aren't going well, then you can say, this is going to be ugly on film, it's going to be ugly, but I can keep this guy from getting sacks because I'm just going to turn it into a fist fight. You know, I'm going to turn it into a straight fight.
Right.
And it may look ugly in the end, but if he doesn't get to my quarterback, I mean,
yeah,
you know, bottom line is I've done my job. I mean,
yes,
I've had situations where I'm getting grabbed, you know, and they're running some type of tackle end game. I remember Trace Armstrong come flying around when he's playing with Miami, flying around and about ready to sack Elway. You know, and I'm getting grabbed, and he's my guy coming around, and I didn't get off my guy like I should have. And here he comes flying around there, and just reach out and grab him and tackle him by the face mask, you know. And just getting on the ground, getting peppered with flags, you know, and him dog cussing me and going, hey, dude, I got to do what I got to do to keep you off this guy. And so, there's the mental part of it, but you've got to be able to handle that. You know, you've got to be able to handle, you know how hard it is, Paul, to get your, I mean, literally get your ass whipped and to get back up and to keep fighting. I think that is one of the things that probably sets the tone, and it's the difference maker between being a successful professional athlete and not.
Yeah.
Because it's like being a comedian, man. You've gone out there, I'm sure, and just completely bombed a show. And to the point where you're like, oh, my God, there's no way I can ever do this again. And yet something inside you goes, no, you know what, I'm not going to let this beat me. I'm going to get back up. And my feeling in professional sports is most people don't make it, not because they're not athletically gifted enough, is because they can't handle it mentally. They can't handle bombing that show and still having the intestinal fortitude to pick themselves up and say, you know what, I'm not done yet. I'm going to keep scrapping and keep fighting.
Well,
and I think that's what really sets most people apart.
That's a really good point, because I think that's the component that you can't gauge in scouting for the NFL or scouting for big-time college ball, right? Like, you're a perfect example. 10th round, three-time Pro Bowl, three-time Super Bowl champion, Pro Bowl, one of the greatest offensive linemen that's played. Okay, Tom Brady, right? Low draft pick. Okay, greatest quarterbacks ever played. Matt Leinart comes out top of the draft.
Right.
And nothing against Matt. I'm not, you know, trying to be, you know, mean or whatever. But, like, that's the component. That's that it factor that, you know, no matter how brilliant a GM or a coach you might be in assessing talent, Is that that's the key component in your mind why guys coming out of Division I ball into the NFL make it and don't, is because that ability to be mentally tough and adjust and keep their emotions in check? Is that the key in your mind?
Yeah, to just be able to play at that level, and being able to play at that level has all those components in it. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is you're never playing the blind sisters of the poor. I mean, every guy that plays in the NFL can play.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you know, there are guys that we call them look like Tarzan, play like Jane guys. guys that have gigantic, enormous, we also call them first off the bus guys. You want to send that guy off in a shorts and no shirt off the bus to intimidate everybody else on the other team. But don't, for the love of Pete, don't put that guy in the game because he can't play a lick. And then there are guys with not an ounce of body or an ounce of muscle on their bodies.
Yeah.
They can come off the football and just shorten your neck. I mean, they just have whatever it is, they have it.
There's something going on inside.
Right.
Yeah.
And it is. There's that component of physicality, of just, you know, whether it's machismo or not, I don't know, but there's part of that. There's part of having that confidence, and there's just part of that, I'm not, regardless of what happens to me, I'm not giving up. I'm not going to quit, you know. And the difference between playing a professional sport, you know, like we talked about, with whether you screw up at work or you screw up, you know, doing a set in from a comedy standpoint, you know, it's embarrassing and you walk away from it and it hurts, you know, emotionally it hurts. But in professional football or you know, other professional sports, it not only hurts emotionally, and you're doing it in a grandstand, you know, you're doing it in front of 65,000 fans and a whole, you know, a whole TV audience of however many million. But not only that, but to add insult to injury, you know, or injury to insult, is you're getting a snot. It's like somebody, it's like you bombing at a comedy show and then somebody coming and beating you with a baseball bat afterwards too. Hey, by the way, you really stunk, and let me hit you, let me give you a couple of raps over the head with this baseball bat just to make sure you realize how bad you were, you know. At least you don't have to deal with that, and that's part of the professional sport that I think that, you know, the guys of weaker constitution, they just flat can't handle it. And I've seen a lot of very talented football players that just can't handle the, you know, the physical abuse, the mental abuse.
Yeah,
and it is abuse. It's flat out mental abuse.
And you got to remember, these guys are, you know, when I was 20, 21, 22, what, right? You're still a kid. You know, you're coming out and you're handed a contract. And talk about that. I know you have to jump in a bit, but I wanted to just have you touch on when you have a disruptive player on the team. How much self-policing goes on within the locker room? I'm not asking you to name names. If you want to, you can. But it's more interested in, like, how is that dealt with within the organization, within among the players? I mean, like, is that the first line of dealing with it? Like, you guys sort of self-police, and how does that work? Have you been part of that?
Yeah. The interesting thing is that you have to understand how kind of how a locker room works, if you will. And you've got to have a very strong team to have the team self-police. Mm-hmm. And the team wants to self-police. But the bottom line is, I was kind of, if you took a delineating line and drew it through the locker room, mm-hmm. there are the majority of guys that are going to be professionals, and they're going to come to work, and they're going to do their job, and they're going to be prepared. They're going to do all that stuff.
Right.
And if you have one or two guys that are on the other side of that line that aren't professionals, the locker room can police itself, and they can pull those guys over the line and make them be professionals, because they'll be social outcasts if they're not. But if you get too many bad guys in a locker room, too many of those guys that aren't professionals, it's amazing the gravitational pull toward being a turd.
Really?
Those guys have
it starts to spread like cancer. You see personalities change from good guy to bad guy because of a couple of bad apples.
I've seen guys ruin their careers. Young players that were going to have promising careers, where you brought a couple of dudes in the off season and through free agency or whatever, that were bad guys, and that gravitational pull. Like I said, if you have one or two guys that are bad apples, all the good guys on your team can bring those over. But you get three or four or five guys, and they'll start pulling the guys that are straddling that fence, they'll start pulling them over, and then then there's nothing. It gets to the point where there's nothing you can do within that locker room, and the only solution is to have an organization that's gutsy enough to fire everybody.
Yeah.
And the problem is most organizations don't have that. Only the great organizations are able to do that on a and the great ones don't bring those guys in. They may bring, like the New England Patriots, they may bring one guy, maybe two. You know, they'll bring Albert Haynesworth in and give him a shot. If he doesn't change, they'll cut him.
Yeah.
And you've got to be able to do that.
Did you find a commonality among these bad apples, if you will? Like, did you find that they started to get some money and acted they could get lazy and figured that they were God's gift to the world? Like, was there some over the course of playing and being around some of these bad guys? Was there a common thing that mistake or bad road that they would go down?
Yeah, I think obviously the money has something to do with it. You know what I think more than anything. Is that guys that are so incredibly gifted, not all of them, but a lot of guys are so incredibly gifted athletically that they've never had to work.
Oh, yeah.
And they can get by, and they can still be the best player on the team without working.
I completely agree with you. My son plays baseball. He's 13. I know your son plays for the Baltimore Orioles right now. And there was a couple of kids on my kid's team when he was 7, 8, 10, 9, 10 years old. One kid in particular, like clearly the star. And because he was so good, he was indispensable. And he would go throw tantrums if he didn't get a call strike that he wanted, whatever. And they would let it go. And I believe a lot of this bad behavior that we see in players now starts when it's enabled by parents and coaches when they're young kids, and just because they've been treated special their whole life, so they act now at 25 with a ton of money and cars and guns and this and that, that they could do whatever they want because they think there are no ramifications to their actions.
And here's the problem. When all of a sudden Father Time starts to catch up with them and they have a little injury and they have something, and all of a sudden they're pretty much even, or they get in the NFL and their skill set isn't so dramatically, isn't so dramatically better than everybody else's skill set. Now all of a sudden they don't have the skills to actually prepare and to study and to make adjustments. You know, we talked about all the adjustments that you have to make as an offensive lineman. They don't have that skill set anymore. They don't have that skill set at all because they never developed it.
Yeah.
And now, I had to change as I continue to get injured and continue to have problems. I just had to continuously change my game to the point where it was like, listen, I can never get myself in trouble because athletically I can't get myself out of trouble. So the key is don't ever get yourself in trouble. And that takes preparation and that takes study.
Yeah.
In 6 years in Denver, and you think in about 1,500 plays a season on average. Mm-hmm. 6 years, 1,500 plays a season. I had 3 missed assignments in 6 years.
Wow.
And they still eat me up. Most guys have 3 missed assignments a game. I had 3 in 6 years at 1,500 plays a year. Not because I was brilliant, because I'm not. It's just because it was from a preparation standpoint. I was going to be the most prepared guy out there simply because if I got myself in a bad position athletically, I couldn't get myself out of that position anymore.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, a lot of these guys who have been blessed athletically and have been catered to and have a sense of entitlement, those guys don't ever make those adjustments, and that's the problem.
Thank you so much for doing this, Mark. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, buddy.
All right, buddy. Bye.
We take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf.
Because it's all our turf.